very happy to have with us here in the studio our monthly check-in. This is the start of the month. We always have our check-ins with the BC Cooperative Association, talking about the sort of across-sector view of the co-op sector. We have John Kay. He's the vice chair of the British Columbia Co-op Association and the CEO at Realize Strategies Co-op. Tom Armstrong is the executive director of Co-op Housing Federation of British Columbia. He's sharing with us the latest news on co-op housing developments and the challenges facing local housing co-ops. And Ross Gentleman is the director, a director at CCEC Credit Union and a blogger on credit union matters at cufutures.ca if you want to check that out. Thanks for joining me, gentlemen. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Robin.
To you.
I think really what we were hoping to hear about tonight is what's in store for co-ops in 2018. I know we've been talking a lot about the sort of climate of cooperative understanding changing a bit at the policy level. Now we're looking at a provincial budget coming in February. Is there anything that is sort of it being anticipated? I know, Tom, for housing co-ops, we're always anticipating some changes there, especially with the climate changing. Is there anything in particular that you're expecting to see in this coming budget?
We are. You know, this is, I think what we're about to see, if everyone keeps the promises they made in different elections and different budget proposals, is the transition from planning to introduce more housing supply into the market to actually building that supply. And that's what I'm looking forward to in 2018, the beginning of a building boom in co-op and community-based housing.
Well, and that should be what, you know, kind of all of our conversations the last 2 years have been leading up to. So, yeah, let's hope. And I mean, we all kind of are assuming that's going to be the case because it seems to be that climate across Canada. Now, John, you just came back from Ottawa in December. Dale talked to you from there, actually, at the last show. Are you noticing a climate that is very favorable to co-ops there at the federal level?
Yeah, and it's interesting, Robin. It's very favorable at both the political level and at the staff level. We had, as I was saying last show, we had about 43 meetings with members of parliament, some ministers, and right across the board with all parties, the response, the reception to co-ops and to our message was very, very strong. There is now a new group in one of the federal departments. I think it's Industry, Science, and Economic Development that has the co-op file. And the staff there are very enthusiastic and really trying to figure out what they can do to support co-ops at the federal level.
So I have to admit, I'm not totally knowledgeable about how it all works up there. Is it an important thing to have the staff on board?
Yeah, it's incredibly important, Robin, because, of course, they provide policy advice to the minister and to the federal cabinet. So having them on board is important, but it's also important because they play an important role in bringing the rest of the federal bureaucracy on side, their counterparts. And that's incredibly important to seeing policy change. It's not just a matter of getting ministers or MPs on side. It is really important in any of these policy changes to make sure that the public service itself is supportive.
And so I know sort of the co-op folder, the co-op package used to be under agriculture, and then it now moved to small business. Is that where it still resides with the Liberal government?
Yeah, so it resides in the small business branch of Industry, Science, and Economic Development, and it now has a line minister, the Minister of Small Business, assigned to it, and a small policy group within the Small Business Directorate that is directly responsible for co-ops.
And are you feeling like that's the appropriate place for it?
Yeah, it is, because the important thing, Robin, is that's also the federal department that has all of the regional economic development agencies across the country. So the agencies that provide various loans and grants and supports to businesses across the country, of which, of course, co-ops are a very important part. And I think we've been very successful in generally educating those agencies about the role that co-ops play. I mean, some are already very supportive. The Regional Economic Development Agency for Quebec is incredibly well plugged in, as is the Atlantic Canada Agency. Some are really coming along, but, you know, I can say, having sat through a meeting with them in Ottawa, there's really cause for optimism.
Well, cool. And I know the federal budget just came out in the end of the year there, and obviously we saw some great advances for the whole housing sector. Are we seeing some indication of support for some of the stuff that co-ops and mutuals of Canada have been asking for around, you know, special funding for co-ops, around some increased funding for those co-ops that might be converting to a worker co-op model from a traditional business? We got that's one of the things that CMC was pushing for us, mm-hmm. and also the Worker Co-op Federation for some funding around that transition nature. Have you seen or hearing people talking about that kind of stuff?
There's two specific things that we've been talking about, Robin, with MPs and ministers. One is a $10 million budget to support the implementation of Motion 100, which called for the creation of a national framework for cooperatives. So that's one. The second is to have the feds put in $25 million, a $25 million investment into the cooperative investment fund. So $25 million, $5 million over 5 years as an investment in the fund. And I'm cautiously optimistic.
That's essentially matching the funds that the cooperative sector itself has put up.
That's right. That's right, Russ. And it was at the request of the federal government, who said to the sector, bring some money to the table, and then we'll talk about it. So I think the feeling is cautious optimism that in the next federal budget, in a month or so, we may see some movement on one or perhaps both of those items.
The M100 thing is still very nebulous to me. Like, what would it? What do you need $10 million to? What are you going to do with that to create a framework? What is this framework that you're kind of anticipating?
So it would really be a number of things, Robin. You touched on one of them. It's things like supporting co-op development across the country. It is providing supports for the development of things like Aboriginal cooperatives, youth cooperatives, and a couple of things that the holidays have managed to clear out of my head.
Yeah.
But really, it's to provide the money to help the sector enable the development of a cooperative strategy for the country.
Okay. So it's really kind of figuring out what we need to know in order to put together a strategy for co-ops across Canada. Yeah. And is that looking to be led by CMC, or would that be something that the government might actually take the lead on?
It's a good question, Robin. The next step in the process is supposed to be national consultations, which would be led by Industry, Science, and Economic Development. There hasn't been any specific mention of CMC playing a co-lead role, but having said that, I wouldn't be surprised to see the minister go in that direction, which would be consistent with what has been done on the social finance side, where it's very much a co-creation process that the federal government's put in place.
Well, thank you very much for the sort of the federal report there and drawing back from, I know it was a month ago that you were there. It is exciting times, and it's, you know, it feels like a very much a long time coming that we're able to feel this climate of support from the federal level. Very much looking forward to that and seeing where it goes. And then looking provincially, it sounds like the next budget that we'll be talking about is our provincial budget. Is there anything that, we'll get to talk a bit more about housing in a minute, probably a lot more, but I'm curious if there's other co-op related stuff that the BC Co-op Association is looking forward to seeing in that budget.
I think what we're looking forward to, Robin, is a couple of things. One is major movement on co-op housing. The other is the beginning of a dialogue with the province on a few specific issues. One is some amendments to the Co-op Association Act to make it easier for co-ops to fundraise, for example, to raise capital. We're hoping over the next year that we can get the Minister of Finance to commit to working with the Securities Commission to change some Securities Commission rules that make it very difficult for community investment co-ops to raise funding. And really, we're just in the final stages of drafting a paper with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives in Vancity that really says, as a sector, we can support ourselves. what we need is a willing partner in government to make some policy changes. So that's what we're looking for, just that opening salvo that shows that the government is very much keen to work with us, and over the not just this budget, but over the next couple of years, to make some changes that will really benefit the sector.
It is exciting to think that we do also have this provincial government that seems quite amenable to co-ops, quite favorable. Hearing that, and we've actually covered some of the stuff around securities rules in the past here on Each for All. I mean, these are not difficult things for a government to change, essentially strokes of a pen. And so, yeah, it is, it's encouraging to see some changes. I mean, we heard about the gaming changes that the BC Co-op Association and Van City and others helped lead. And we saw, you know, community service co-ops now being able to apply for gaming grants again. What's your sort of feeling about the security rules? Do you think that this ability for co-ops to have a easier capitalization sort of scheme, is that going to be a pretty easy win for us?
I'd like to think so, Robin. The kind of changes we're talking about are not without precedent. They exist in other provinces, other jurisdictions in North America. They don't cost the government a nickel, and they're not really asking the government to do anything from a policy point of view that is particularly risky. So we're hoping that Carol James will see that as something relatively easy to say yes to. And that she'll be willing to encourage the Securities Commission to make those changes. So, yeah, we're hopeful.
Cool.
It sure doesn't hurt to have a it doesn't hurt to have a premier who not only knows co-ops but is enthusiastic about them. You know, occasionally, you know, you might question the value of annual excursions over to Bologna to check out the co-op housing sector, but the premier went to Bologna as part of the Van City tour a couple of years ago, and according to more than one cabinet minister that I've spoken to, came back talking about nothing but co-ops and how important it was to stimulate the growth of the co-op economy in BC. So that's you know, he may not be in the weeds on the co-op policy initiatives, but having that sympathetic ear, that enthusiastic ear in the premier's office sure can't hurt.
For well, sure.
And also another key ministers, Tom, I know you were saying before we came on air that you've had very good discussions with Carol James. We know that the Minister of Agriculture and her officials reached out to folks in the ag sector across the province to talk about co-ops just in the last couple of months, and really keen to understand how co-ops fit into agricultural policy. So, and I know, like you, that there are other ministers who are really strong champions for the co-op sector. So that all points to a really bright potential for our sector over the next few years.
Yeah. Carol James was, for many years, the one voice on the Select Standing Committee on Finances and Government Services who spoke up consistently in defense of housing co-ops and other co-ops and the need to create fiscal frameworks that were supportive. And now here she is, the Minister of Finance, so it couldn't have worked out better from that angle.
That's pretty exciting. Ross, I'd like to hear from you. What do you see for the sort of financial cooperative sector coming up in the coming year?
Oh, well, there's several fronts where it's kind of unfolding as we speak. There'll be some more negotiations between the provincial government and the sector regarding legislative change. There'll be consultation papers sent out, we're told, this month by the government, and we'll be able to respond to that. Central One, which is the Credit Union for Credit Unions, has a legislative committee, and I'm sitting on some working groups there that are going to be reviewing particulars with respect to the legislative framework. On other fronts, so the minister has made it clear that the minister would like to see us more active in the world of financial literacy training in the public sphere, and potentially more active in the world of payday lending, as creating alternatives to payday lending. And I think those are potentially really interesting places for the credit union system to develop stronger positions.
So are they asking, you said the minister is talking about this?
The minister has pushed this back. There's
specific to co-ops?
The game goes out here. These guys are putting a really nice spin on it. But the game is, there's a quid pro quo that as you want something, the government is going to say, well, if we give you something there, will you be able to contribute something elsewhere? And this is part of the exchange that we're having in the current climate.
Mm-hmm. So is it specific to co-ops, this ask, or is it sort of the financial sector in general?
It was not specific to co-ops.
Yeah.
She was more concerned with the polls that have been taken and research that have been done in the recent past regarding financial literacy in the general populace. And not reaching the kinds of levels that it ought to be at.
Yeah, I feel completely illiterate, but and I know credit unions have taken a bit of a sort of leadership role in the payday lending stuff. Vancity in particular, yeah, putting stuff out. CCEC does something similar,
We do similar things at CCEC. Yeah. We don't promote them in the same way, but we're working with more closed membership, so it's not a street level offering. Vancity did develop their Fair and Fast Loan product and tested it within the Vancity world, and now sharing the model and the materials and the framework with other credit unions so that other credit unions can implement it as well. Yeah. And I haven't looked at their program assessment in any way in the last 6 months anyway, but they were really pleased with the way it was unfolding. There's other opportunities. You talk to other operations, and particularly the smaller credit unions, they get to know people, mm-hmm, and they're more likely to give loans to people based on character or based on whatever, yeah, not being as concerned about the small size loans, because often small size loans are as complex and as staff demanding. They introduce the same staff demands as a large loan. So many smaller credit unions will say, yes, we'll give you a $1,000 loan for whatever it is, a month and a half, or 2 months, where standard practice in the industry is, no, you should have a credit card. Just go and get a credit card. Hmm. And many people just don't have a credit card or wouldn't qualify for a credit card.
And so are you seeing any other financial institutions outside of the co-op sector starting to look at some of these more ethical things with respect to payday lending? Like, is RBC and TD looking at these at all?
No.
Okay.
No. And that's why you see the whatever. I can think of at least one branch. I think it was a Commerce branch on the corner of First and Commercial. Used to be a bank, and now it's a payday lender.
that's quite telling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think Ross makes a good point, you know, around this quid pro quo. I mean, there always is one, right? But to my mind, that's the nature of partnerships. And I think it's so encouraging that the government in more than one aspect sees the co-op sector as worth reaching out to say, you know, what can you do in the public policy sphere that can address the government's agenda while we support the co-op or community sector agenda? And I think that's a good point to make, and I think it's a positive development.
Yeah, and Tom, I mean, we've talked for a long time about the community land trust model that you've been putting forth, I think what I took away from this, and you've mentioned this a number of times, you're no longer asking for grants, you're no longer asking for handouts, you're looking for partners, you're looking for people to basically come in to this thing with you. You're bringing stuff to the table and looking for others to bring it as well.
That's right. We want to attract investors, whether that investor be the government or private equity, social, you know, driven by a social mission that may be more patient and not as demanding as mezzanine financing. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to say to the government, we don't want a grant in the same way that we, you know, structured housing programs in the 80s and the 90s. We want you to put your money in to fill an equity gap, because there still is one. Expect a reasonable return, but commit that return to being recycled back into the production of more affordable housing. So you're not in it as a traditional investor might be. And there are governments now and community impact investors who are willing to filter or underwrite an investment opportunity through that lens. And we think it's very encouraging for the sector.
Well, I do want to talk a bit, a bunch more about housing in a second, and I do think that we are going to talk a little bit about, you know, that financial literacy piece again. I think the CMHC is bringing in all these new rules effective yesterday to deal with or try and mitigate Canadians' debt load. I'm going to take a short station identification break here, and then we'll be right back on Co-op Radio. This is Each for All, the Cooperative Connection.
You are listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
And we're back here on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. My guests tonight are John Kay from the British Columbia Cooperative Association, Tom Armstrong from Co-op Housing Federation of British Columbia, and Ross Gentleman from CCEC Credit Union on Commercial Drive. We're talking about what is in store for co-ops in 2018, and we're going to talk a bit about co-op housing and some really interesting stuff coming up. As we talked about earlier, there's some federal funding coming for a housing strategy. Also at the federal level, some really interesting changes lately in the CMHC, the Canadian Mortgage
Housing Association or
Corporation. Yeah. Canada Mortgage Housing Corporation.
Glad one of us knows it anyway.
Our federal crown agency for housing has been around for 75 years.
Yeah, and I apparently have given them some money at some point in my past. But,
oh, you have.
There's big changes here. This is, seems like the Liberal government putting their big stamp on the CMHC. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on there, Tom?
They sure have, and I'm so happy to talk about this because I will admit right off the top that I did not see this coming. And no one, I don't think anyone, really took it seriously when the government said they wanted to make their they wanted to transform the housing sector, starting with the governance of Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. CMHC operates with a 12-member board that includes the you know, the president, CEO of the corporation, the deputy minister to the minister responsible for CMHC, and the deputy minister of finance, and then 9 people who are appointed by order in council. And these people have always come from the insurance industry, the real estate industry, the financing industry. And lo and behold, the government said, you know, several months ago that it wanted to refocus CMHC on the, you know, what we're calling the community housing sector. And they wanted to start with the governance of the corporation. And CMHC is a big ship. I mean, they make $1 billion of profit a year just on their mortgage insurance operations. This is profit. It doesn't go back into housing. It goes into general revenues to fund other government services. So that's the money you talked about giving to CMHC at some point. And you and millions of other Canadians. So
let me start you. It's really a hidden tax, but I'll let Tom now go on.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And that needs to be reformed. But so here they are, and everybody, you know, I'll just speak for myself. I thought, as I think many others did, when they said we want to transform CMHC to make it a more activist player in the social housing or community housing sector, we thought, sure, you know, that's good talk, makes a good sound by good media releases. But just before the holidays, they announced the appointments to the board, and they have transformed the board of directors of CMHC fundamentally at the governance level. They've appointed, on a 5-year term beginning at the end of April, a new chair of the board. His name's Derek Ballantyne. I know him because he's also the CEO of Incasa Financial Inc., which is the fund manager owned by the community housing sector in Canada, former head of the Toronto Community Housing Corporation, one of the most dedicated, passionate advocates of social and community housing in the country today. Another name you might be familiar with and never expected to see her on the board of CMHC is Janice Abbott, the CEO of Atira Housing Society. And Janice is nothing if not a housing activist. She won't be standing up reading the lines that are prepared by government media release writers. And Linda Morris, formerly Senior Vice President of Community Investment at Vancity, a former executive with the Desjardins Group, Anne Giardini, Chancellor of Simon Fraser University. I mean, this is a total remake of the CMHC board. Now, I have to say, because we always thought it was irrelevant to the work we are doing, we haven't spent 15 minutes in the last decade dealing directly with the CMHC board. But I can tell you that's sure going to change.
So what do you anticipate? If this radical change in the direction of the organization at the board level, what kind of impact might that have?
Well, see, that's the thing that remains to be seen. No, unless it's been extremely well hidden, no board of CMHC has ever been able to put a stamp on the policy or delivery direction of the Crown Corporation. But what we're being told is that these appointments would not have been made if that were not the expectation of the government and senior levels of the public service. So they are expected. And I know Derek well. He would not have accepted an appointment to this position if he didn't know that he had a mandate to make the kinds of changes the government's been talking about. So we expect now to see, and it's not going to be overnight, but he does have a 5-year term. It's going to be, I think, a shift to a more cooperative, a more partnership-oriented Crown Corporation that's going to be able to deliver significant aspects of the newly announced national housing strategy in a way that actually engages the community housing sector in a true partnership to build and operate and invest in more and more affordable housing in Canada. So beyond that, I know I don't know what the specifics are, because as I said, these appointments don't take effect until April. But I can tell you, we can hardly wait for that first meeting with the new board.
Does seem pretty exciting. Obviously, a massive change. I'm not totally clear what CMHC does aside from mortgage insurance.
Well, you could easily be forgiven for that, because for the last couple of decades, that's all they've done, arguably. I mean, they've administered $2 billion worth a year in existing subsidies to social housing projects across the country, and that amount, as we've discussed before, has been diminishing, and none of it has been plowed back into social housing or community housing, and that's about to change as well. And that's it. They've cut their research division to the bone, and that's going to be, I hear, rejuvenated. But that's about it.
Okay.
So you can expect to see more, I think, from CMHC. I know the staff here, the local staff at the Vancouver office of CMHC, can barely contain their excitement about the role they're going to be asked to play. And finally, creating housing for Canadians whose housing needs are not being met in the market, rather than just acting as a housing bank or a mortgage underwriter for people who can already afford housing in the market.
So you talked briefly about the national housing strategy at the federal level. We've talked a lot in the past about how, for decades now, since the 80s, there really hasn't been a national housing strategy. And I think Ross might argue against that, in that we don't pay capital gains when you do sell a place for more than you bought it for.
Yes.
Well, I'm with Ross on that one.
There's an implied strategy there. There wasn't an explicit strategy.
Yeah.
But it certainly has been, the effect of it has been to create massive, enduring subsidies for homeowners in this country. And homeowners in Canada are the most massively subsidized players in the housing market of anyone.
Yeah. But now the federal government is kind of, they're getting back into this national housing strategy game. For the last few decades, they've just been giving money to the provinces who have their provincial housing strategies. How effective is it going to be to now be sort of, taking reins again in some sort of a national housing strategy? Are they going to be able to really have an effect at the provincial level?
Well, that's, I think, the $64,000 question, and I hope they don't see it in just the way you framed it. I hope they don't see it as now making a change from feeding money to the provinces to keeping the reins at CMHC. Because now they have an opportunity, and it's an opportunity I don't think that has presented itself literally for decades. We have a provincial government, one among many, who've made a significant 10-year commitment to investing in affordable housing. We have a national housing strategy that makes a similar 10-year, a long-term strategic commitment that goes beyond an individual budget or an individual electoral cycle. And we even have the City of Vancouver, which I think just unveiled the most progressive housing strategy of any municipality in Canada. The most activist housing strategy. So for the first time in my memory, we have all three levels of government here, right here in an area that we're playing in, committed to long-term strategic investments in housing. The only way to mess that up would be not to coordinate those efforts and coordinate the deployment of those resources. So it's not, you know, federal or provincial. It's federal, provincial, municipal, and for the first time as a significant partner, the community housing sector. And that's, to me, the big challenge in 2018 is, can we create a common table that has at it significant players at the federal, provincial, municipal, and community levels to coordinate the deployment of those now massive resources into the development and maintenance of more affordable housing. If we can't do it, it'll be the biggest missed opportunity in our housing history. If we can, it will produce phenomenal results.
And so I know for British Columbia, that picture looks pretty much like you laid it out there. Is it the same in other provinces? You mentioned other provinces, but is your sense that the other provinces are kind of, I don't know, I want to say shovel ready in that respect?
You know, it's I'll just say I'm happy to be in BC.
I think I'll chip in. I think you're absolutely right, Tom. We're happy to be in BC. One of the provisions of the National Housing Strategy is that it's keying on substantial contributions from the provinces.
Yeah. Mm.
And we happen to be living in a province that is doing better than many in the country. So our provincial government is in a position to make the kind of commitments that they have made, which is our advantage at this stage. But
totally.
When you go to some other provinces, they won't be able to match the federal money in the way that the National Housing Strategy anticipates they will. So they may not be as forthcoming to co-fund.
And even if they thought they wanted to, they may not have the mechanisms or the platforms in place to do it. I mean, my poor colleagues in Ontario, you know, you'd have to go all the way back to Mike Harris days in the 90s. When he devolved housing from a provincially delivered focus to 47 individual municipal service providers. And can you imagine trying to organize a provincial contribution to housing to match incoming federal dollars that had to be filtered through 47 individual municipal service providers? I mean, it's a nightmare.
Yeah,
so I wish them all the best, but I wouldn't want to be trying to do it.
Another question I have, and maybe this is not a big deal, but I'm going to ask anyway. The National Housing Strategy, my understanding is some of the funding is kind of contingent after the next election cycle at the federal level. Is that correct? And
yeah.
What does that do for that? Is that a drawback?
Well, it positions the current government to bring up positive message to the next campaign, that's for sure. I would be a lot happier if the money had been front-loaded
instead of now, Tom is really lined up beautifully to support a certain party in the next election.
Yeah. Well, see, and that's the conversation that's going around the table.
Right. Yes.
And it is to some extent an awkward position to be in, because we want to support certain outcomes without being partisan in the election or, you know, in between elections. But it is going to make it a lot more difficult and make it a lot more nuanced dance. But yes, we'd be happier if more of it was front-loaded.
Yeah.
But
well,
there were existing agreements between the feds and the province that do need to run their course through 2018-19.
Mm-hmm.
And the new money is meant to kick in to replace those agreements as they expire. So,
okay.
So that's the official rationale, but it certainly would have been possible to deliver more of the money sooner.
Okay. I mean, that when I hear about that, and I know in just conversations that is something people bring up as the kind of like thorny.
It's an irritant, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, an irritant, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that I just wonder if you're trying to get the provinces on side, if that's one of those things that's kind of a bitter pill to swallow.
Well, in a way, it gives the provinces more say during the period of time that those agreements still have yet to run their course. Mm. So the new rules, whatever they may turn out to be, and the federal government is determined to bring, you know, what they would call more accountability into the federal, provincial, territorial fiscal framework. It gives them a couple of more years to argue over the fine points of that that accountability framework. And those conversations, I know from speaking with people here provincially, have not been easy ones.
Mm-hmm. Any more to say on the national housing strategy there, Russ?
Oh, you're looking for me to be a provocateur here.
Well, you're the only person I know that's just willing to, you know, you got no agendas.
Well, the one thing that I think I understood from reading through the document when it was published a month and a half ago, I looked at the amount of money that the feds were actually committing, and I don't think it's going to be a whole lot more than what they have been committing for the last 10 or so years, about $2 billion a year. But they are targeting the housing co-op sector in a far more direct way. So the housing co-op sector is going to get continued support for the existing co-ops and support for new co-op development, which is great. But they're giving us the impression that there's a whole lot of fresh money being committed here too, and most of that fresh money is either provincial money or borrowings, which they're throwing into their larger totals, which are part of the game anyway. And for them to inflate their totals by just adding in the borrowings, it seems to just overstate the nature of their program. However, it's all good. Just let's not call it too radically different.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. That's a fair comment. But it's also the model that we said we wanted the government to pursue. You know, we want this. They're calling it a co-investment fund. You know, which will include some grants, but more investments or loans. But loans at over longer amortization periods and at lower rates, because CMHC's direct lending rate beats anything else available in the marketplace, because they have access to offshore money and they can hedge over a longer period of time. And that is actually a game changer, because if you can take the debt service that might have been crippling to the first 10 years of a new housing development pro forma, if you can actually make principal and interest payments for that 10 years based on a 50-year amortization schedule and then refinance at the end of the 10 years with more favorable on more favorable terms, you've gone a long way to reducing the gap between economic and market rent and to creating more affordable housing on the ground. So, you know, it's a new game. Nobody knows quite how it's going to work, not even CMHC, not the community housing sector. We just know there's a tremendous opportunity there, and we have to take advantage of it.
Well, hopefully other provinces are looking to BC and the interesting opportunities that you've been working on here to try and get some actual housing co-ops built. That's not happened very often in the last 35 years.
It's happening now.
Yeah.
And all of your listeners, in order to keep current on the news, should, before they go to bed tonight, they should join Co-op Radio, so they can stay in touch with the news that we're going to be unveiling over the next 6 months.
That's right. Co-opradio.org, if you happen to be sitting at your computer right now. Thank you, Tom.
Had to be done.
You are, of course, listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio. This is 100.5 FM in Vancouver, and we are at co-opradio.org, live online, listener-sponsored radio here. So if you do want to become a member today, do visit co-opradio.org. Tom is our biggest supporter for new members. Can't thank him enough. It's great to talk about that. Now, we are talking about the cool stuff that's going on here in British Columbia and with the Community Housing Trust, Community Land Trust. Mm-hmm. I understand that this continues to evolve. You guys, are people moving in now?
They will be in 10 days.
Yeah,
Not in the new construction that we've been talking about either. That will be more June, July, another 315 units on the Fraser River down there around South East Marine Drive and Kent and Jellicoe Streets. But in 10 days we'll accept a transfer from the City of Vancouver of that beautiful new building that you see right on the corner of East First and Quebec. 95 East First is the address. It's It's in big letters right up the side of the building. It's a white and brick building, 135 units, studios, one, twos, and threes. And you'll notice as part of that development, Concert Properties has been, they've got four buildings up in that area. And as part of the city's community amenity contribution program, Concert was required to build that beautiful new building at 95 East First and give it to the city in return for the opportunity to increase the density that was available on the rest of the site. So it really is, this is a good illustration of how, you know, how much money there is in real estate development, that you can say to a developer, you have to build us a brand new 135 home tower and give it to us in order to have the right to build everything else you're building on that site, and it's still a viable, profitable venture for
the developer. Mind-blowing.
Totally. Yeah. Anyway, but it's a great idea. The city's done a great job of extracting some of that profit, some of that benefit that really is a comes from the public purse in the first place. That's land that you know, the city had control of, and we'll be creating a standalone co-op or an expansion of the existing Athletes Village co-op. And beginning in 10 days to 2 weeks, we'll be accepting applications to move into that building. Now, what's really neat about this, and it illustrates the benefit of actually having access to an asset in land and buildings like that. There's another co-op in East Vancouver called Aaron Webster Housing Co-op. It used to be City View Co-op, but it was renamed. Everyone knows who Aaron Webster was, and at the time of his death, he was the president of City View Co-op. So they renamed the co-op, and their co-op is 31. Homes in very poor shape. They suffered from catastrophic building envelope failure. Weren't doing well at all. Couldn't fit under CMHC's financing framework. The city is on the verge of condemning the property. So we're going to take the entire membership of Aaron Webster Co-op and move them into the new building. So there'll be 31 of the 135 units. And then the co-op is going to move its land, which it owns, into the land trust. And we're going to redevelop that site to take it from 31 to 70, 75 new homes. So we're not just going to get 135 co-op homes. We're going to get more than 200 in that transaction. That's the benefit of you know, what we call a swing site, where you can get around that whole displacement issue, which bedevils people who want to talk about redeveloping and densifying existing co-op sites. So we think we can do that many more times if we get the right combination of vacant land or new buildings from the city. And that's all through a community community-based real estate developer whose mission is not profit, but affordable homes for people.
That's so cool.
We can hardly wait. Come on down for the opening. You can broadcast live out of the lobby as we move people in.
We would love to. So give us the time and we'll be there. That is just so exciting. So when did this all come to pass with this 95 East First?
It's been, it was part of quite a long process. The city issued requests for proposals to a list of pre-qualified community operators and developers, and the Land Trust submitted its proposal and was the successful proponent. So,
wow, awesome.
And it didn't even create a debate at council. It was adopted on consent, which meant they didn't even want to talk about it. They just wanted to do it, give us the building, and let us get on with it.
I feel like the Community Land Trust must be the envy of a lot of cities and provinces around Canada.
We're hoping, we took a resolution to the last annual meeting of the Co-op Housing Federation of Canada, urging the members to encourage the board of the National Federation to invest a minimum of $1 million to create capacity for new co-op development across the country. And we haven't seen a lot come of that resolution yet, but we're hopeful because their annual meeting is in Victoria in June. And I think they'll be motivated to bring some good news.
Very cool. Ross, CCC is having their AGM coming up.
Yes, on the 7th of February. Any CCC members out there, come on out to the AGM at Café du Soleil on Commercial Drive at 6th. 50 or 6th there, yeah. And we usually have, sometimes over 100 people out. We have a good time. There's be food. The bar will be open much of the meeting.
and the best door prizes of any credit union annual meeting
we'll
in
have
the sector.
Some great door prizes, I'm sure. Yes, so that's coming up.
Awesome. Any other AGMs or things on your guys' minds this evening? We got a couple minutes left.
Well, one thing, Robin, and I think we've talked about in the past, that CMC's annual Congress will be in Victoria this year.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, I think it's June, if I remember the dates right, June 26th to 28th. So I know that the chair of the board is very keen to see other co-ops in BC come, even if they're not members of CMC, but to be able to come and see what it means to have a national association, what it means to have a provincial association, and to really get some exposure to what's going on in the co-op sector across the country. So for any co-op BCCA members that are listening, or not members who should be, make sure you get the details from CMC's website.
Awesome. I was just on there this evening. There's a great year-end letter from the president of CMC there, and it's great to kind of hear, 2017 in recap. So looking forward to seeing some of the stuff we discussed tonight come to fruition in 2018. Thanks so much for coming into the studio tonight and discussing all the future of the co-op sector here in British Columbia and hopefully across Canada. And really looking forward to seeing how 2018 unfolds here with the check-ins on each role.
Sure.
It's going to be a great year.
It's going to be a great year for us.
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you.
So we're going to leave you tonight with a little Feist. This is Past in Present. And you're, of course, listening to Vancouver Cooperative Radio. This is your radio station. Become a member if you're not one. Go to cooperadio.org. I'm your host, Robin Puga. We'll be back next week.